participant numbers are starting to slow down. So thanks everyone for joining us this morning. We really appreciate it. And I'm now going to turn it over to Dean Tomaselli.
Thank you, Pam. And again, let me echo my welcome to thanks again for being with us today. We're in the midst of a confluence of crises right now. Country one, fortunately, is ebbing, and the other has been with us for far too long as we deal with institutionalized inequities, discrimination, and racism in our society and culture. We at Einstein and Montefiore recognize that we have a special role to play in that the determinants of health are, and one of the two of the largest determinants, social and economic. And we continue to work in this space, work with other agencies and other parts of the government to try and make sure that we're doing everything that we can to improve the situation. In contrast, the news regarding the COVID pandemic remains good. The number of patients in the Montefiore Health System has decreased to a number below 150. I think the last adult patient at CHAM with COVID was discharged. We still have children with COVID. We still see a number of patients in the emergency department who have this viral infection. The good news is most don't need to be hospitalized. We do hope that the recent gatherings and protests don't lead to a resurgence of cases, but we're keenly aware that that's a possibility and on the lookout for that. So even as the clinical work slows down a bit, the research remains on COVID remains robust and continues to grow. As I've told you on a number of these calls already, that we have active therapeutic trials that are ongoing at Montefiore and Einstein, and these include the second phase of the remdesivir in combination with baricitinib trial by Dr. Zingman. We continue to enroll patients in the convalescent plasma trial that's being led by Dr. Lizan Porofsky. And there are a number of other studies of immunomodulatory drugs that might be important in controlling both the infection, but importantly, the immune response of the host to that infection. The basic science labs continue to be very active. And in fact, we are now in the process of ramping up activities on the Einstein campus in those laboratories, not only for COVID-related research, but other research as well. The tangible outcomes thus far have been the development, as I've mentioned, of tests for exposure to the virus, an important improvement, we believe, in serologic testing, trying to better understand the infection itself and the host response with the ultimate goal of producing better therapies, whether that's antibody therapies, cell therapies, or small molecule therapies in activities led by Drs. Kartik Chandran, Dr. Lai, and Dr. Everest Gavithiotis, as well as many others. Certainly vaccine development is front of mind as well, and understanding the viral infection allows for better development of vaccines, and Dr. Harrells has been a leader in this space. And fundamental understanding of the viral infection itself will inform us about better ways to treat, for example, some of the complications of this disease, including multi-system inflammatory syndrome of children. And I know Dr. Harrells will talk to us about that in a few minutes, as well as the risk that adults have with this disease in developing blood clotting. We're also in the process of developing a biorepository for samples of virus, samples from patients that would be generally available for use in clinical and clinical translational studies as we move forward, an effort led by Dr. Stein, Keller, Shamoon, and others. So lots of activity that's ongoing. And I think what I'll do now is introduce Dr. Betsy Harrells. It's a pleasure to have her with us today. Dr. Harrells is the Harrells and Muriel Block Chair in Pediatrics. She's the Vice Chair for research in that department, as well as being the Chief of Pediatric Infectious Disease. She directs the Translational Preventive Research Center. In addition to being Professor of Pediatrics, she's a Professor of Microbiology and Immunology, Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Women's Health. And it's really a delight to have Betsy be able to talk to us for a few minutes this morning. So, Betsy?
Great. Thanks very much for inviting me to join on this call, and I'm glad there's so much support and interest in this area. Just as a kind of very brief background, kind of off the COVID subject for 1 minute, because I think it will explain where I'm coming from in terms of thinking about COVID and working with my colleagues on COVID. I actually started out my career as a pediatric infectious disease physician, and I still practice pediatric infectious diseases over at CHAM, with an interest in why viruses are such a problem and how viruses interact with the host, the human being, and why some people get really sick and some people don't. And most of my laboratory work has really focused on a very different virus, herpes simplex virus, which, as you all probably know, is mostly associated with the common cold, can also be associated with a sexually transmitted infection, and is highly linked to the HIV transmission. And our lab has worked for years on understanding that virus, which I happen to think is one of the smartest viruses out there, and we all tend to give our viruses brains like humans. And it's this, one of the smartest viruses because despite years and decades of effort at making a vaccine, that virus continues to escape scientists. And if you're infected with a herpes simplex virus or any member of that family, that virus stays inside your body for the rest of your life, periodically waking up and either causing an asymptomatic infection that can spread or a symptomatic infection. So by understanding how that virus can evade the immune system, we've learned a lot about immunity. And that led us to uncover, pretty much by accident, in collaboration with my colleague Bill Jacobs here at Einstein, a completely different approach to the vaccine. And I'm not going to talk about that, although I'd be happy to answer questions about that. But we have a vaccine candidate that's now being developed into the clinic that works by very different mechanisms. And what I mean is that most vaccines, and this is going to be true about SARS-CoV-2, and that's why I'm bringing it up, most vaccines, the underpinning idea is that we want to develop antibodies that we call neutralizing antibodies. And what a neutralizing antibody is, it's an antibody that can bind to the viral protein that's on the surface. So in the case of my virus, HSV, it was binding to a protein called glycoprotein D. But in the case of SARS-CoV-2, it's binding to that spike protein. And when it binds to that protein in the laboratory, it decorates the viral particle so that the virus can't find its receptor and can't get into a cell. In the case of the herpes virus, that approach to vaccines, even though the vaccines did exactly what the pharmaceutical companies wanted them to do, they generated antibodies that are these neutralizing antibodies that can bind to the viral particle and block it from engaging its receptor, they never worked. And so what we ended up doing is sort of saying, let's flip this on its head. Maybe that's the wrong kind of antibody. Maybe the virus is smarter than the rest of us, and it can evade, hide from those kinds of antibodies. And so by taking away that dominant protein that all these vaccines were directed against, that glycoprotein D protein, we generated a live viral vaccine that's completely safe and that generates antibodies to everything else except for glycoprotein D, and ends up that those antibodies, instead of neutralizing, do something completely different, which we call Fc receptor activation. By that, I mean the antibody still binds to the viral particle or to a cell that's infected with that viral particle, but instead of decorating it in a way that blocks its interaction with its receptor, it causes your immune system to come in and kill the virus. And we call those non-neutralizing or Fc receptor mechanisms. So switching into SARS-CoV-2, when the epidemic first began, we quickly kind of jumped in and said, wait a second, maybe we need to think in a similar way about this. And the second thing is, what was really interesting and unique as a pediatrician about this virus when the epidemic first started is that kids were not getting all that sick. They were coming into the hospital, we were seeing them, but they were coming in with fever, not much else, and going home in 2 or 3 days. So with my colleague Marla Keller, who the dean just mentioned, who helped us set up a biorepository, we jumped on getting a biorepository going, focusing both on children and adults. And then in collaboration with my colleagues, both other colleagues at Einstein as well as colleagues at Yale that I already had collaborations immunologically with, we began studying what's different about the way the kids are responding to this virus versus the adults who do okay versus the adults who do really poorly. is there something we can learn? Like, are the kids a natural history experiment of who does well and why they do well? And then as the disease progressed, we began to see these children with this multi-inflammatory syndrome, and then we added them into our cohort. So without kind of giving away where we are in the research, because we're still in progress and I don't want to jump to conclusions, it looks like what we learned from the herpes virus vaccine may be telling us something also about this virus. And by which I mean that the kids who do very well and the adults who do very well are making antibodies. So all the kids make antibodies just like the adults, but those antibodies look like they work by the same mechanism that our new candidate herpes virus vaccine works by. Not necessarily by neutralizing. It's not that they don't neutralize, they do, but they have this ability to activate that Fc receptor and kill virally infected cells rapidly through different mechanisms. And it looks like, and again, this is very early data, so I'm not taking it to the bank yet, that the adults who do poorly and the kids who have that multi-inflammatory syndrome aren't making as many of that type of antibody. And I think this has implications for vaccines, because you've heard a lot of talk on the television, websites, New York Times, what have you, whatever you're reading, you know, about neutralizing antibodies. And I'm not saying that they aren't necessarily good, but they may not be the whole answer. And so I'm hoping that we can have the vaccinologists keep that in the back of their mind and realize that we might need to make these other types of vaccines. So I don't know if you want me to keep going, or I can stop here and sort of answer some other questions or talk about other areas that we're also working on.
Well, maybe you can keep going and talk a little bit about maybe MISC and some of the other things that you might be doing that are related to COVID, and then we can stop and
so,
take questions.
Yeah, so just very briefly, so I just mentioned, so we've added the MISC kids into this biorepository and into our laboratory work. And what we're seeing with the MISC kids, which is similar to the adults who went on to have sort of this cytokine storm and ended up with requiring mechanical ventilation, but also, as the dean mentioned, developing clots and some of these other complications, they have an inflamed system and they're not making as much of this other type of antibody. And we think they may even have different T cell responses. So we may be getting a lot of good immunologic clues. But the other important thing from a clinical care standpoint that we're doing in the Department of Pediatrics is we've begun to invite all of these children. And I do want to say that despite the scary headlines about this multi-inflammatory syndrome, and it is very frightening, all of the kids have gone home so far from our hospital to date and have done overall very well. So, you know, supportive care is working very well for those children. We may be, we're testing some immune modulatory therapies, but in general, I just want to reassure people that those children are recovering, and that's a very important thing. But we're bringing those children back into a multidisciplinary clinic that we've started at CHAM that involves the cardiologist, the rheumatologist, and the infectious disease physicians, as well as the hematologist, to really make sure that we understand what happens to them, what the long-term sequelae of that is, and again, also to invite those patients to participate in these kinds of research studies so we can understand what this disease is about and learn from it. And it may even provide clues to us to the mysterious disease Kawasaki, which I actually started my residency career research in, and to this date, we don't completely understand. So there may be clues that will emerge from this that will help us with that. And the last area that I think is important that we're also working on is understanding the impact of this virus on pregnant moms and their babies. And so we've got two projects going on in that area. One is related to just collecting blood from the pregnant moms and from the cord blood from the newborn babies to look at whether the babies really are getting infected, to follow those babies up, and again, in a multidisciplinary clinic in combination with the obstetrician, so it makes it easier for the families to come in together to find out, do those babies actually seroconvert? In other words, were they exposed and do they develop antibodies to this virus? And are there any clinical sequelae to them? And then again, trying to understand the immunology of this virus. So I think those are some of the exciting things that are going on right now.
Terrific. Betsy, thanks. A couple of questions, perhaps. So in your work, have you identified any way to figure out who amongst the adults or children might be somebody who, other than the typical risk factors, who might not do well with this infection, either because they get overwhelmingly infected or they have a very exaggerated immune response, cytokine storm, for example, and do poorly for that reason. Are there clues that help people?
Yes, and one of the beauties of having a colleague like Marla Keller, who jumped on writing an IRB very quickly to get us a biorepository going, is that we were able to collect remnant serum. So that's, you know, a patient has blood drawn because they're sick, but there's leftover blood in the lab, to take advantage of those, what we call remnant sera, and to look even on day one when they walk through the hospital at some of their immune markers, so some of their cytokines. And interestingly, there are differences. So the kids in general look very different than adults at baseline, which is kind of fascinating. Now, whether that's something about their immune system in general, we know the kids' immune systems are different. They've seen different viruses and other pathogens. You know, they have a different microbiome, and you can think of a lot of theories here, and we don't know the answer. But the cytokines look different in the kids to start with. And the patients who go on to do poorly start out already earlier on with already some of these inflammatory markers being higher. So not the ones that the lab draws, although those are true too, but some of the ones that we're looking at a research standpoint, some of the other cytokines that look very different. So we're hoping we are going to be able to identify who's going to be potentially at risk, and that way we can intervene earlier. And there was hope, as everyone knows, that remdesivir would be one of those things, because maybe it's the viral load that's playing a role here. That's not so clear anymore with the follow-up remdesivir studies. So I think the jury's still out on how important ongoing viral replication is and how important something about the host is and the way they see the virus and the way they immunologically respond.
Terrific. You mentioned Kawasaki disease. What's your expectation regarding long-term sequelae or consequences for children who've developed MISC? Do you think they're going to develop the same kind of blood vessel dilatation that we see, for example, in Kawasaki disease over periods of time, or other manifestations that are longer term manifestations?
So it looks like, and I'm smiling, although you can't see that I'm smiling, because many of us kind of were a little anxious when they first started using the term Kawasaki here. So the data across the country, and I just checked on this with our cardiology colleagues at CHAM, because they've been in contact with the other cardiologists all over the country and all over the world, is no. These kids are not developing the coronary artery aneurysms that we see with Kawasaki that lead kids who have Kawasaki perhaps to having premature coronary artery disease as adults, even when their coronary artery vessels improve after they've gotten IVIG therapy. So even though there are some clinical manifestations that are indicative of a vasculitis, of inflammation of endovascular cells and so forth, that are similar, I don't think these diseases are going to be identical, although by studying MISC or the pediatric multi-inflammatory syndrome, we may indeed learn something more about Kawasaki-like illnesses. But so far, it doesn't look like they're going to have any of those sequelae. This is the reason we set up this clinic at CHAM, is to follow up these children, and we've actually invited people throughout the community, you know, including at other hospitals that had this illness, to come to our clinic for these follow-ups so we can really understand potential long-term sequelae. There is some concern that some of these kids have very high D-dimers, which is a marker of problems in their clotting pathway. So whether they're going to be at risk for some kind of thromboembolic phenomenon isn't clear yet. But I think these are all things that we need to follow along and see. Right now, these kids look like they're doing really well, and I think that's very reassuring.
Yeah, that's actually terrific news. So you did mention, and part of the strength of your lab is vaccine development. And, you know, we know Moderna has an RNA vaccine. The Oxford group has another vaccine. So what's your impression? Do you agree with Tony Fauci that we're likely to have a vaccine by the end of the year? Or are you skeptical? Do you think that it's what is your prediction about the development of a vaccine for COVID-19?
So I would hate to ever disagree with Tony Fauci. That's not a good political thing to do. But I'm a little concerned that he's overly optimistic. And so again, the reasons are, First of all, it's interesting that so much effort is getting put into these RNA and DNA approaches to vaccinology. And the reason I think that those approaches are getting a lot of positive fueling is it's an inexpensive way of making a vaccine, and it can be highly immunogenic, meaning you can get a really good immune response. That being said, there are no vaccines FDA approved out there that use that technology. So I do think we also need to look at old school technology that's worked. And I would like to see effort put into some of those more old school technologies in parallel, just to see. But the other reason I do have concerns is, again, this sort of tunneled vision, that what we need is neutralizing antibodies, when we actually don't know that. And I say that because it's failed for other viruses. If you take the flu virus vaccine, we know that we don't have a universal flu vaccine. And part of the reason is that the virus can mutate. But part of the other reason is that we've been somewhat, stuck on this approach of making those neutralizing types of antibodies. I think our clinical data, our research data that we have from these samples that we've been collecting from patients here at Montefiore and also at multi-center studies, suggests that neutralizing antibodies may not be the whole answer. And when we look at the patients who are very sick and in the ICU, they have sky-high antibody titers, and their antibodies are neutralizing. So they're making that kind of antibody that the vaccine's trying to make, but they're still getting sick. Now, that being said, that is different than having the antibody present before you even see the virus, which is what a vaccine strategy is, right? That's, you're going to have pre-existing antibody, you're going to be vaccinated, tomorrow, and you haven't seen the virus yet. And maybe if you already had those antibodies, you'd be protected. But we don't know that yet. And so I think we have to be very cautious. I hope I'm wrong, and I hope Tony Fauci's right, and he probably has a better track record than I do. So that would be a good bet.
Yeah, we can hope for him being right on this occasion. But I would agree with
absolutely.
You. Absolutely. Challenges in developing vaccines for lots of RNA viruses and other viruses. So perhaps I can ask you to put your pediatrician's hat on and give some advice about sending kids off to camp this summer if we're in kind of the current state. What are your concerns? What do you think ought to happen if in fact parents are out there thinking about sending kids to summer camp?
So I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer to that question. I think obviously it depends a lot on your geography and the environment. I do think that kids, we know that children can be infected with the virus, albeit the admissions are lower than the adults, but nonetheless, the children replicate the virus just the same as adults seem to. In fact, the viral loads seem higher. So they are potentially infectious. That being said, they, unlike other viral infections, the common cold, which is also a coronavirus, they aren't sneezing, and they don't seem to be a big source of infection. So I don't want to tell anyone to not be concerned or to suddenly start kissing and hugging all of their nieces and nephews and grandchildren. At the same time, I don't think the children themselves are as super high risk, which is something people were very worried about when this epidemic first started. Nonetheless, they can get sick and they can get this MIS-C condition. So I think we need to proceed with caution, but I think we also need to balance that with mental and other aspects of our health. So I think there are ways to have summer camps that can be appropriately managed. I think you need to make sure that the counselors and the healthcare workers are at the camps are not infected. I think you need to be able to practice reasonable social distancing with camps, which is going to take some creativity. But that doesn't mean it's impossible to do. And I think that, there are lessons from some of the other countries. I think Denmark was one of the first countries to have their kids go back to school, but they did it with shifts, so there weren't that many kids at a time. They were, different parts of the day, different kids were there. You could see pictures of them on the news at recess time playing, but there were like circles on the ground and how far apart the kids had to be. You could still play ball and so forth, but you were keeping a distance. So I think it's doable with creativity. I don't think it's go back to the way it was last summer. I don't think we should be doing that.
Great. So Betsy, thank you so much for spending some time with us this morning. This is really enlightening and great to hear from you. If there's anything that, what are the things, as a final kind of comment, are the things that you're doing or that are being done in support of kind of research on COVID that are real targets for needing some help? That is, what are the philanthropic targets for the development of programs around this disease and management of this disease from your perspective that should be front and center?
So I think that is really more the basic and translational research. You know, the clinical trials are well supported both by pharmaceutical industries and by the NIH for that matter. But I think in sort of the things I was talking about earlier, understanding what's a good immune response, why are the kids or the adults who do really well, and again, more so the kids, doing so well? Because if we can understand the underpinnings of in natural history why some people do very well, then we can really design the vaccine much better. And that doesn't mean that the first vaccine that gets out there, which might be, you know, 40% effective or 50% effective, shouldn't move forward to start to, you know, ameliorate the problems of this viral infection. But understanding the underpinning immunology is going to be important not only for this one, but the bad news, but I think the real news, reality news, is that there are going to be other viruses that emerge, whether they're other coronaviruses that come from other bats, whether they're viruses from other animals, other species, we don't know. But I think we'd be putting our heads in the sand if we didn't think that there are going to be new viruses that keep emerging. And so understanding the basic immunology here and the translational immunology, even more than the basic, I'm one who believes that human samples is the way to go more than mouse studies and cell culture studies. If we can really, you know, pinpoint what's going on here, I think that will help not only with this virus, but the next viruses to come. So, you know, support for that kind of translational work that I described in the beginning, I think would be critical. And often it's very hard to get because, you know, it kind of falls in the middle. It's translational research. And while everyone likes the name, it's often the hardest type of research to get funded.
Great. I think that's an important lesson and something that's good to end on. That is looking out for not only what's going on now, but what's going to emerge in the future. So, Dr. Betsy Harrell, thank you so much for being with us today. I want to thank everybody for being on the call today. Thank you for joining us. Have a great and safe weekend, everybody. Thanks.
Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.